Three, two, one, go.
Merry Christmas, Matt. Let's rock and roll.
Is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, welcome one and all to the weekly edition that you know, love, and look forward to. It is the Grahamian Report. We're about to embark on our fringe foray for the week, but also engage in a bit of Yuletide cheer because it is effectively our Christmas episode. And boy, did we all get a real Christmas present over the weekend. More on that in a moment, but first allow me to introduce my co-host with the very most, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Good evening, sir.
Good evening to you as well.
Interesting times, Matt. So, over the weekend, big news dropped. That's right, New York Times and other leading media agencies reporting, and rather credibly, on a secret Pentagon UFO program. Yeah. Now, normally, I'm very cautious about these things, and you can expect that same caution on tonight's program, but in hour two, we are going to be delving very deeply into trying to understand every element, all the nuances, try to tie together all the loose ends and understand exactly what is going on, who is behind it, and how they did it. What you need to know about all this, and it will relate to far more than just UFOs, I can tell you that much. A lot of politics, a lot of dollar bills floating around, too. Interesting times indeed. So, well, it was naturally a very busy weekend for me, working on projects behind the scenes, Mr. Matthew, but...
It's always a busy weekend for you.
Yeah, exactly.
I know, I just kicked back all weekend and just thought, that Micah guy, he can do it all himself.
Yeah, that's right. of course. No, Matt was over here with me last night trying to work out some of this, in fact. In the heart of the Hollow Earth... In the bunker, bunkering down, trying to make sense of the madness, as always. Quick hi to everybody there in the chat room. My lovely assistant, Lauren, is in there, I think, isn't she? Yeah, there. No, wait. Where did she go? Maybe she'll be in there. but I'm sure she's out there someplace, and no doubt tuned in, listening. I hope a lot of you guys are out there listening. If you'd like to interact with us during the program, whether or not you're actually in the official KGRA Radio chat room, and that, if you want to join us, is kgraradio.com/chat. To join, but you can also tweet at me at Micah Hanks. We'd love to get interactions and information from you guys out there as you're on the move or perhaps on the hunt for information. Internet sleuthing is advised during these broadcasts, so mote it be. So, maybe we'll kick things off as we're looking at the news here, Matt, with a little information. I got to tell you, actually, here's one thing that's on my mind. My good pal James Waldo. James usually is tuned in and listening to and sending along info on various things. Poor James was marooned last night. He was one of the many casualties of this unusual shutdown that occurred at the Atlanta airport last night. Yeah, there were people still sleeping on the floor, CNN reports, the day after a power outage shut down operations at the Atlanta airport, but long ticket and security lines were moving slowly as normalcy began returning to the world's busiest airport Monday. Matt, I know you have some fond memories of the Atlanta airport.
Oh, I love it. I love spending $10 for a Corona just so I can smoke.
That's absolutely right. Now, Mondays and the holiday breaks are busy times for Hartsfield-Jackson International in general. Frequent flyers said that the airport felt a little busier than usual, especially in the terminal that hosts Delta, our preferred airline here in the bunker, whose headquarters are there in Atlanta. The line for Delta's Sky Priority passengers zigzagged back and forth 7 times and was still backed up to the main entrance to the airport. Matt, you know, with all the calamities that ensue when I fly, I'm amazed that somehow I wasn't in Atlanta when this happened.
I am too.
How did I miss this?
You've almost been the victim of a domestic moron terror attack.
I was, yeah, right here in my hometown of Asheville. That was the scariest flying incident.
Yeah.
I have been selected for random frisking by the TSA. I've been made to throw away all kinds of things.
See, you have to take my advice. The first time Micah and I go to an airport together, I wear my Prince t-shirt with the large love symbol on it.
That was clever.
And I said, you know, see, nobody will mess with you if you have a Prince shirt on because they know that you're one of them. Yeah.
I'm like, oh, sure, whatever. But sure enough, we get up there and immediately the TSA agents are like, oh, man, you know, I'm from Minneapolis, dude. Prince, they love Matt immediately. Yeah, well, it worked.
Like checking out my tattoos and just shooting the breeze with me.
It was the most uneventful trip I think I've had this year flying with Matt. So that was on our Mysteries cruise with Mike and Wendy. Had a really good time. Anyway, so folks down there at the Atlanta airport, you know, some were saying, I mean, again, that the lines looked to be the longest that they had seen. Volunteers in shirts that said, ask me, tried to allay concerns and passed out donuts to those in line, many of whom shared horror stories about the night before. And while some fortunate passengers were able to board flights departing Atlanta, other passengers were being told that they'd have to wait for hours or even for days. James, if you're listening out there, wherever you are, text me, let me know where you are. And in fact, if anybody else out there is still stranded or still grounded at very least as a result of what happened in Atlanta over the weekend, I would like to hear from you. Tweet at me at Micah Hanks. We'd like to hear from you. But there was something else interesting that was going on down there. And this was brought to my attention. I'm cautious with the source, okay, which was squawker.org. But McNonymous brought this to my attention of Middle Theory fame earlier today. We were wrapping up after, again, the craziness going on over the weekend. We had to fill, I think we had literally had to spend 3 days and two different recording sessions to get the Middle Theory podcast done. And we did an extra lengthy 3-hour episode for the Christmas holiday special. Although we didn't talk all that much about Christmas. We talked about everything, and we did a 2017 conspiracies wrap-up. And yes, we did talk a little bit about this UFO thing that we're going to be spending a lot more time on Graylin Report tonight discussing. But all that said, we'd already done a plus 3-hour show. And then as I'm getting ready to sign off, really had to get back into Graylin mode here. Chris says, hold on, Micah, before you go, I'm sorry, I've got to, and I said, this is unusual. Chris is actually making me stay on the mic longer. So we're already going more than 3 hours. He says, but you need to hear about this. Apparently late last night with the sudden power outage shutdown there at what many are calling the world's busiest airport, you know, again, having traveled through it many times, I would agree, there was something kind of interesting that was going on down there. And according to users on 4chan, they were reporting that during that 12-hour air traffic shutdown in Atlanta, a single plane was mysteriously allowed both to land and to leave the airport. Now, at first, I wasn't really all that interested in this. And again, I maintain that with the news source, if you want to call them that, that's reporting on this, maybe it is something that at least should be paid attention to, but cautiously so. And what they report, according to the 4chan users, so this is mostly rumor, speculation, and hearsay, the plane in question was a 4X ICB, a cargo plane that arrived in Atlanta from Mexico City at about 1 p.m., just literal minutes before the alleged power problems that began to make the airport go dark. By the way, alleged, that term, that yeah. Terminology is from their article, not my own. Okay. But what we were told is, of course, that there was a fire that broke out that affected electrical systems and also the backup systems, and so they were out of power for about 12 hours. The plane landed and then would go on to leave for its next destination at 6:27 p.m., right in the middle of the blackout that ran from about 1 until midnight, with the official record indicating that the first flight post-blackout was not allowed to take off from the airport until 12:56 a.m. the next day. The question on the minds of many is, how did this plane land and then leave in the middle of this outage? Why were they allowed to? Here's what we know about this company and what has been said about them. Cal Cargo Airlines is the company. They specialize in transportation of non-standard cargo, apparently like live animals, dangerous goods, things along these lines. Now, apparently also, Cal Airlines owns another business, which is called LACHS, or LOX, a company who operates at the Atlanta airport, loading and offloading cargo planes. Now, what they say, according to their website, they have a customs clearance notification on their website. I'm going to read from there right now. It says, the process of clearing customs has traditionally presented challenges and delays for critical time-sensitive shipments when lag time can translate to significant financial setbacks. At LOX, our warehouse is fully bonded, and we have established a customs simplification process to ensure timely handling of your cargo. And here's the key right here. Our customs approved process includes the ability to load and unload trucks without the presence of a customs agent, or print customs documents locally rather than traveling to the customs office and clear customs documents simply and more quickly than ever before. So what had raised the suspicion of the 4chaners, apparently, was that no one outside the company's own employees there at LOX, based partially in Atlanta, were aware of what was inside the plane as it either landed or took off from the airport, and, of course, was allowed to take off during all this. Now, again, there are a lot of insinuations that are being made now, and so I'm going to stop right there, because there are people saying this was a secret weapons smuggling program. How convenient that the power went out in Atlanta when this plane was allowed to land without having to have customs agents involved. It lands and then takes off in the middle of this massive 12-hour blackout, and then presumably carries weapons over to Israel or wherever else. And shortly after, we recognized Jerusalem as being the capital of Israel. You know what I mean? So I don't know exactly what to make of this story, but it is somewhat interesting that in the midst of that great big power blackout, one plane does land and take off.
It is. You were the first person to point this out to me. I'm still trying to make heads or tails of it. So
it may not be anything is the whole point, yeah. But I do find these kind of things interesting, and so maybe we'll keep an eye on it. What's most interesting is the fact that usually something like this is great mystery fodder, and yet the mainstream media hasn't even reported on it. Nobody's reporting on it. Nobody is taking advantage of being able to get the clickbait going and report on something like this. So why?
I think they've taken advantage of clickbait. Let's, maybe not on BuzzFeed or something like that, but people take advantage of this. And I think that's the natural progression. When mainstream media outlets don't cover this, that's part of the mystery that adds, why isn't anybody talking about this?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, why isn't anybody talking about it? Oh, I know. Because, of course, this weekend would be the one weekend in the last century or so, well, maybe not the last century, but at least say the last half century, that UFOs have been treated seriously by mainstream media outlets. Yeah. Wow, it's just bizarro land. Everything is backwards. We're in the upside down, just like the kids from Stranger Things. It's incredible. Everything's weird and freaky and upside down and different down here, Matt.
Who are you from Stranger Things?
I don't know.
You don't know? You haven't laid awake at night thinking about this?
Maybe Winona Ryder's character? I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, exactly. With my motherly tendencies. Hey, a couple of updates on things that are happening, which we talked about on last week's program. Last week NASA and Google were announcing that their advanced computer analysis has discovered two new planets around distant stars, including one that is part of the first star system with as many worlds as Earth's solar system. Now, we were very interested in what NASA would have to say during this big announcement. Apparently, our solar system now is tied to the most number of planets around a single star, with the recent finding of an eighth planet circling Kepler-90, which is a sun-like star 2,545 light-years from Earth. The planet was found in information from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope. Now, the recent discovery of Kepler-90i, a sizzling hot rocky planet that encircles its star once every 14.4 days, was determined using machine learning from Google. So this answers one of the big questions we had last week. What was Google's involvement and why their AI division? Well, because, as we suspected, machine learning was going to play a significant role in this. And yes, of course, the headlines now read, "To discover exoplanet, NASA will use artificial intelligence." So echoing what we said last week, how much more 2001 can we get? In this case, computers studied to recognize planets by finding in Kepler data instances where the telescope recorded signs from planets beyond our solar system identified as exoplanets. Just as we assumed, exciting findings are hiding in our archived Kepler data. In other words, technical jargon and data we've had on hand for a while, and we've been waiting for the right tool or technology to uncover them. This, according to Paul Hertz, director of NASA's Astrophysics Division in Washington. Now, he says, and I want you to think about this for a moment, because we're going to tie this in with more timely things going on in the news in a moment. This conclusion records that our data will be a treasure trove accessible to innovative scientists for years to come. The invention came about after researchers Christopher Chaillu and Andrew Vandenberg instructed a computer to learn how to recognize exoplanets in the light readings recorded by Kepler, which are the minuscule variations in brightness obtained when a planet passed in front of or transited a star. Encouraged by the way neurons connect in the human brain, this artificial neural network sorted by Kepler data, and obtained weak transit signals from a previously missed eighth planet encircling Kepler-90 in the constellation of Draco. While machine learning has earlier been used in searches of Kepler databases, this research shows that neural networks are a promising tool for determining some of the weakest signals of faraway worlds. Other planetary systems apparently hold more promise for life than Kepler-9. And in fact, about 30% larger than Earth, Kepler-90i is so close to its star that its average surface temperature is assumed to exceed 800 degrees Fahrenheit, Matt. That's on par with Mercury. Its outermost planet, Kepler-90h, orbits at a comparable distance to its star as Earth does to the Sun. So interestingly, again, we've been gathering data. We didn't know exactly how to process it, what to do with it. And then machine learning helps us spot new things. And now we're able to spot exoplanets using the assistance of intelligent computer software. And once again, I mean, I hate to keep saying, hey, this is what I thought years ago, but something I wrote about in that book that I wrote, The UFO Singularity, was, what if in the future, artificial intelligence is something that is useful in helping us find alien life?
I believe I read a book about that once.
Yeah, it might have been the one I just mentioned.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you something too, Matt. The other question I have is, as we see what's happened over the weekend, and with the release of, you know, video that is showing again, and yes, I got to give props to Tom DeLonge, at least for this. And again, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm being too critical of him. It's important and necessary to maintain cautious skepticism when these kind of things are happening. But Tom DeLonge, former guitarist of Blink-182, as we're going to delve into later in the show, a guy who my kid brother Caleb worked for a while, a fella who has had a long interest in this subject and maybe would qualify for being the least likely person to get political action going behind and media awareness of the UFO subject in any kind of credible way. It was to the Stars Academy, which he announced, and we had Alejandro Rojas on the program to talk about when he made his big announcement. It was DeLonge and his organization and Luis Elizondo, formerly with, of course, the Pentagon UFO investigative group that we're going to be talking about, that helped get all this on the map, so to speak, over the weekend. And they also were the ones who were behind the release of a couple of new disclosed pieces of footage, which appear to show what they call a tic-tac. And they call it that because they say the object is roughly the size of a school bus and it's shaped like a tic-tac, and that they were trying to track this thing. But questions I have are, if we as humans can't make any sense of this, because that seems to be the consensus right now, nobody seems to know really what we're dealing with. What are these things? What are these UFOs? Many people have gone all in on aliens. And meanwhile, while the astronomers are out there looking for evidence of alien life and using machine learning to do it, we just learned that we had Pentagon officials who have been studying a technology, at very least is what they'll say, for which the origin cannot be determined. Will machine learning, and this is my question, I'm sure you see where I'm going, would, and I asked this in the UFO Singularity, if this phenomena, whatever it is, if it exists, will machine learning help us learn something about it? If we are on the cusp of having technologies, advanced artificial intelligence, or at very least precursors to that, that help us learn things and discern things from data we collect that the human mind alone can't do, I think within the next 10 years, we very well could be looking at not just exploration of space and observations of things far off, but maybe certain phenomena that are interacting with and occurring here on planet Earth, or at very least in our airspace, and we may have some resolutions to that through data and through analysis and through the implication of advanced learning systems like these very programs that are being utilized by NASA in conjunction with Google. So, I don't know. It's going to be interesting if people who'd said that my book was about nothing but made-up ideas and silliness end up having to eat their words, but I'll just say that again.
Not that you want that to happen or anything.
Yeah, there are other things they could eat if they want to, really. You know, enjoy a hamburger. How about a steak? Or if you're a vegetarian, there's some delicious salad.
Veggie burger.
Exactly, yeah. Black beans, you know, things like that, yeah. So get some proteins in there. But the at the end of the day, the point I want to make is we, I think, live in an era where we need to be cautious but open-minded, because it seems to me that there are a lot of interesting discoveries occurring. In fact, this was a groundbreaking year by NASA's own estimates alone. The number of discoveries, the number of innovations that have occurred with our space program. We need to be cautious, but we need to be forward-thinking, we need to be open-minded, and we need to be very careful, because there are a lot of things that are going on that may change the way we think about things we thought we knew. Something else we were talking about last week, and we were cautiously optimistic about, was this interstellar object that's been taking a little detour through our solar system. And discovered on 19th of October, the object's speed and trajectory did strongly suggest it originated from beyond our solar system, but some people were saying that it could even have been, well, something artificial. Now, the first known interstellar asteroid, Oumuamua, we've reported on it. According to these new determinations, remember, SETI researchers and all different kinds of scientists were looking for possible signs of radio emissions or whatever else. Well, we didn't find any of that. As we expected, we probably wouldn't. But what we have found is that the asteroid may hold water from another solar system, but in its interior. Apparently, they say the body of this object showed no signs of outgassing as it approached our sun, which strengthened the idea that if it held any water, it held very little. But the latest findings do suggest that water might be trapped under a thick carbon-rich coating on the thing's surface. The results come as a project to search for life in the cosmos has been using a radio telescope to check for radio signals coming from this strange object. Astronomers from the Breakthrough Listen Initiative spent, you know, at least an afternoon or two last week looking across four different radio frequency bands for anything that might resemble an artificial signal resulting from an alien form of technology. They didn't find that, but their initial results have drawn a blank. And so the latest research, along with this a previous academic paper on this, support an entirely natural origin for this cosmic interloper. So again, this is what we thought. The latest evidence that we have suggests, again, totally natural origin, not some sign of alien technology. But think about all of this happening at once. I have to say it is rather remarkable that we have so much going on all at once. You know, we're discovering exoplanets and using AI to do it. We're trying to bounce radio signals off of something that was very unusual. An interstellar object that enters our solar system is taking a hike out toward Jupiter right now. And we had the Breakthrough Listen Initiative looking to see if this thing might show signs of alien technology. All that the same week that it is reported by the New York Times, the Washington Post, Politico, Reuters, and various other sundry mainstream media outlets that there was a secret Pentagon UFO program which seemed to confirm a technological, if nothing else, presence in our skies which we cannot account for. My goodness, folks, if this all that we have discussed alone in this first segment isn't enough to surprise and excite you, I just don't know what will. But it is Christmas time, and so we must do our due diligence. And so when we come back, I want to spend a little time enjoying some holiday festivity before we get back into the news of the unearthly things that might be going on out there. Some creepy Christmas awaits in the next segment. It is the Grailian Report. I'm Micah, he's Matt, and we will be back right after this. High mountains of Appalachia. It is the Grailian Report, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. Normally, by the way, a website of unprecedented operability. However, Matt, I noticed that in strange coincidence, the KGRA site had been giving certain listeners tonight 404 errors.
Yeah.
Huh. And all my sites are down on the brand new server. All my emails have crashed.
Do you think it's because we know too much?
I think it must be the aliens. I mean, what else could it be?
I'm with you there.
Cowboy Matt would say so, very least.
He said so earlier today.
He did.
I loved it.
Yeah, we always love to hear from all you guys, whether you are an alien enthusiast, a cowboy from space-time, or a time traveler like Matt and I. You can interact with us a number of different ways. And right now, it looks like Twitter's the way to do that, although the chat room is popping over there at kgriradio.com/chat. So really glad, of course, to see all you guys in there. Maybe the fullest house we've had all year. So happy holidays, seasons, greetings, Yuletide, merry carols, fill your glasses, kick back, enjoy yourselves. We'll get back into the news. Matt, by the way, getting caught up on things, doing what you and Jeremy London have been telling me to do for weeks now. I finally did begin watching Tom DeLonge on Joe Rogan last night.
Oh, yeah? What do you think so far?
Well, it was interesting.
that's a word for it.
It was interesting. Hearing his, again, he's very matter of fact about certain things.
I'm not sure we can talk about this right now.
Yeah, we can talk about it.
You got an email from just a random person?
No. I just can't tell you who it's from.
I guess it's about time to get into our creepy Christmas segment here. Yeah. Now, so the lovely assistant, Lauren, has been contributing, helping, knowing that I've been losing sleep and hair the last few weeks, trying to get everything together here during the holiday season. And so she's been doing some marvelous work behind the scenes, getting segments together for us, in addition to other various sundry things. And she said, seriously, this is your Christmas episode. You should do some Christmas coverage. And I might have forgotten to do that, which would have been, I inevitably would have had coal in my stockings, had it not been once again for Lauren saving the day.
Or Krampus would have come and visit you, of course.
That's right. Yeah. He may still, in fact, based on what I'm about to read here. So first, we're going to look at some of the weird history, the dates associated with this. For instance, the date of December 25th. Christians decided to celebrate the birth of Christ on December 25th, largely because they realized that they would have probably had more luck attracting pagans if they held their celebrations on the main date of people's midwinter celebrations. For instance, Romans, this meant Saturnalia, a feast of orgies, drinking and singing that culminated, of course, on December 25th with, human sacrifices. How pleasant. Children were then given dolls made of the corpses. Huh. How nice.
We have such a pleasant world history, don't we?
Humans are an interesting species, yeah. Let me just say. Let's talk about Santa Claus. There's several theories listed as to what the origins of Santa Claus are. But now Lauren said her favorite was the one claiming Santa used to be a shaman who liked feasting on magic mushrooms, the type that grow at Buckingham Palace. I didn't know that. These northern European shamans would sometimes drink the urine of the reindeer who had chomped on these fungi. Or for the most extreme trips, the shaman would take the hallucinogenic shrooms themselves and then drop into the roofs of yurts and hand over gifts while high as a kite.
I was not aware of this one.
This is interesting.
This
What's a theory?
My new favorite.
It's a theory.
Yeah, okay. It's my new favorite theory.
Really?
Yeah, I love this.
A new theory about the perfect drug. The drugs, in fact, made them think that they were seeing flying reindeer. In Austria, they have the demon known as Frau Perchta, the female equivalent of the Krampus. Krampus's girlfriend, in other words. And in Iceland, they have the Grilla, the troll hag, her Yule sons, such as the sausage swiper and the meat hook, not to be confused with the meat wave or Coco Logic. And also a child-eating Yule cat. We're going to get to some of those, in fact, because one of the links that she sends along, which describes some of these, include 12 of the creepiest Christmas myths from around the world. But I'm going to add another one that's not really creepy. It's just weird and hilarious.
I think I know what you're going for here.
Yeah, I bet you do. So the first one is La Befana. La Befana is an Italian Christmas witch. Not really terrifying, but a very strange legend. She's pictured as an old woman who flies on a broomstick and carries a large bag. According to the old folk tale, she visits children on Epiphany Eve to determine if they have been naughty or been nice. And very much like Santa, if the kids have been nice, she rewards them with gifts and candy. But if they've been naughty, she leaves them a dark lump of coal. You just better hope it's coal she's leaving you. Grilla, probably the creepiest of the Christmas myths. We mentioned Grilla, of course, is a mountain giantess and a troll. According to Icelandic folklore, she travels from the mountains in search of naughty children. And when she finds them, she abducts them, and then she eats them. So is it any surprise that children are rarely naughty in Iceland? They're also well-behaved because they think that Grilla is actually going to come and eat them.
Which is odd because, there is a belief that Santa lives not in the North Pole, but right at the Arctic Circle in Finland, like Rovaniemi.
I wonder what flat earthers think about Santa, because think about this. Follow my logic for a second, okay?
Okay.
Since we entertain theirs all too often. Santa lives at the North Pole, but on a flat earth, we are just, circled by this ring of like ice, and there is no actual pole since it's, just a flat disc. Well, then where's Santa?
Well, you see, it's like those Frisbees, with the thing in the center, the little depression. That's where Santa is.
Yeah, because otherwise, no Christmas?
No Christmas.
Yeah. Explain that one, flat earthers. Explain that one.
Gotcha.
I think we got him again.
The Yule Lads. Call us the Yule Lads, Micah and Matt. In another Icelandic legend, the Yule Lads range from being bloodthirsty murderers to mischievous pranksters. Originally, there were 13 Yule Lads that would travel from the mountains where they live with their mother, Grilla, of course, to the villages to scare unsuspecting victims. Why all this horror around Christmas time? I'm starting to understand the whole tradition, Matt, of the scary stories on Christmas Eve, because everything about Christmas in Europe and British Isles seems to be horrific. Although Iceland isn't part of the British Isles, let's just be clear.
Yeah.
But wherever we go, it seems that there is horror associated with Christmas. This is terrifying stuff.
I enjoy it, and as you and I talked yesterday, I'd found that article in the Smithsonian Mag that actually says, come on. Let's bring back ghost stories on Christmas Eve. So even the Smithsonian's saying it.
Yeah.
I'm with them.
As they should be saying it. And by the way, anybody who thinks it's okay that a great big red-nosed fat chump is going to be climbing down your chimney on Christmas Eve, that in itself is pretty horrifying to me.
Yeah.
Hey, Santa, guess what? You can just stay your big
roast. And he's got lists of all the children. And
yeah.
That's weird.
Is that not weird?
Yeah.
See, I'm glad you would just, yeah, exactly. Everything about this, we need to ban Santa Claus. We need to ban Santa Claus. Getting rid of him.
Well, we have to figure out if he's real from the Flat Earthers first.
Okay, so Flat Earthers in the audience, just get back to us on that first. Okay, I want to talk to you about Jólakötturin, the Icelandic Christmas cat, okay, which dates back at least to the 19th century. According to legend, Jólakötturin is a huge cat that roams the streets around Christmas time, preying on those who don't wear new clothes.
Seems a bit unfair.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But hey, Jólakötturin, what about those of us who can't afford new clothes, okay? Those unable to buy... Oh, well, here we go. Those unable to buy new clothes for the holidays, the Yule cat will eat. Of course. More bloodshed, horror. What?
And an eradication of the homeless problem, apparently.
Actually, most of this stuff, though, is just Iceland. Maybe it's just Iceland that really has the weird Christmas thing going on. Seriously, guys, why is it like Christmas red bloodshed in Iceland? I mean...
See, you're yet to get to the scariest one to me, which is number 6, but we've still got number 5.
Oh, so. I thought, you know, well, we mentioned Frau Perkta.
We briefly mentioned it, but the mythology is horrifying.
Well, I want to talk first about Bell Sneakle. Now, this creepy fellow originated from the Middle Ages in Europe. He was one of the first to separate the good kids from the naughty. However, he did allow kids to redeem themselves if they had been bad all year. Throughout the year, the masked Bell Sneakle would leave candy in nice kids' houses and leave the naughty kids with a switch. Although he never actually used the switch on the kids, the stories vary. In some stories, he would leave the bad kids with nothing. In other stories, he would either abduct them and never let them go home or take them to the forest to punish them for their bad behavior. Okay? So now we have, let's see here, abductions. Maybe this is like getting into missing 411 stuff.
Yeah.
That could be what's going on here. Okay, Frau...
Get David Politis on the phone now.
Get him right now. Get him right now. Seriously, I've got a phone. I could call him. Actually, I could have Lauren call him. Frau Perkta, this scary lady would roam the countryside during winter and enter homes between Christmas and Epiphany, according to Bavarian and Austrian folklore. If kids and servants had been nice, she'd leave them with a silver coin. But if they hadn't been nice, she would cut open their abdomen and take out their organs and replace them with straw.
There's a big disparity between those two. Like, get a couple bucks.
Is Frau Perkta like Hannibal Lecter or something?
Yeah, that's horrifying to me.
These Christmas traditions make Hannibal Lecter seem tame.
Yeah.
Seriously, he was like a gentleman. Okay, so number 7's Krampus. He's one of the more common and probably actually one of the tamer of these legends. It's slowly growing in popularity in America, thanks to guys like Mr. Sam Sheeran and his Christmas coloring book, which features the Krampus right there on the cover. Yeah. Now, apparently, Krampus has made several television appearances in recent months.
And there was the movie that came out last year or the year before, one of those two. It's kind of a horror comedy Christmas. Yeah,
that's right. He was also on television shows like American Dad, Grimm. Let's see here. The German tale goes way back and tells the story of a large horned creature that works opposite of Santa Claus. And once again, he abducts and kills naughty children. Good gracious. Seriously. Giving Sasquatch a bad name. Necht Ruprecht. Okay, similar to the Bell Sneakle, Necht Ruprecht would carry around a switch. He was said to be a helper to St. Nicholas, going door to door to ask parents about their children's behavior. And, of course, if they'd been naughty, he would beat them mercilessly. No, he would just punish them with the switch, which meant that he would beat them mercilessly. This is so disturbing. What was wrong with these people? Pierre Fauterd, similar to Necht Ruprecht, Pierre Fauterd would accompany St. Nicholas. Now, see, this is the thing. Okay, guilt by association. Why did these creeps accompany St. Nicholas if St. Nicholas wasn't up to no good himself? Originating in France and southern Belgium, the story of Pierre Foutard is a pretty sinister one. Of course it is. Lauren, what have you been up to? Why do you sit around reading this stuff all day? Pierre Foutard was a butcher who came across... It's Hannibal Lecter. There you go. Came across three wealthy boys on their way to boarding school, captured them, and robbed them. Later, he killed them, chopped up their bodies, and kept them in a barrel. See? Hannibal Lecter. After St. Nicholas found out, Pierre Foutard was punished and spent the rest of his days following St. Nicholas. So your punishment is that you got to follow St. Nicholas around? You shall forever be my slave!
This makes me wonder about the mythological powers of St. Nicholas we don't know about. Because apparently he has the ability to punish lesser, holiday spirits and...
And evil ones at that.
Evil ones, yeah.
Yeah, but he employs them. I mean, see, that's the whole thing.
I hope they have a good union.
Yeah. So we've got the Kali Kansaros, a malevolent goblin. In southeastern folklore, Kali Kansaros lives underground but comes out between Christmas and Epiphany to play pranks on people and scare them. So he's pretty much the Grinch of mythology. Ah, see, that one's sort of tame. And then the Mari Lud tradition was once carried out in South Wales. If I mispronounce that, Kim Myatt, our official Welsh translator in the audience, she will correct me on that. So let me know, Kim. Groups of men would go around door to door with a horse prop made of a horse skull on a stick, asking for entry to the house in a song. The homeowners would deny entrance through a song, and it would go back and forth until someone eventually gave up. However, if the homeowner gave up first, the group of men would be granted access to the home and would be allowed food and drink to basically cause chaos inside the house.
That's one I could get behind.
Yeah, right? Oh, gosh. They'd ship the china. They'd crack the plates. That's what Bilbo Baggins hates. Well... So there you go. There's some of the horrific things that people believe around Christmas time. And I thought that the big fat guy crawling down my chimney was disturbing. Lorraine in the chat room asks, Mike could do the voice, but say, I am He-Man. I could probably do that. Let's see here. What was the other one? What was the other one, though?
By the power of Grayskull?
Yes, that's right. By the power of Grayskull! The other one I was thinking, too, Matt, was thunder, thunder, thunder! We could probably do this all night. So
yeah, I just want to hear your Snarf impression.
Who?
Snarf, the little Thundercats
thing. Oh, yeah. I don't know. I might have to work on that, Matt. That'll have to happen another time. So, I don't know, other Christmas traditions, the ones that I really enjoy. You know, as a kid, I'll tell you the one that I hated and the one that I've really grown to like. I've definitely grown to enjoy eggnog if served properly.
Yeah.
Nog is quite a fascinating drink, and I got a good ghost story that I'll tell that kind of runs parallel to Nog. But I think the thing I always hated as a kid was fruitcake.
Everybody hates fruitcake.
So why does anybody make fruitcake?
I don't know. It's perplexed me since childhood. It's like a brick that you're going to use it as a door jamb for the rest of the year until you get another one.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is you could leave it there for a year as a door jamb on the ground, and it would still be technically edible year later, yeah.
Which is all the more horrifying.
Yeah. What is it about the chemical, or maybe alchemical, composition of fruitcake that allows it to essentially defy, like, chemistry and biology? It's bizarre. Which is really scary because that's the number one reason I didn't want to eat it when I was a kid is because it looked and tasted like it was already a year or two old. And so my theory at that time was, well, I suppose that probably somebody was given this as a gift and they didn't eat it. They kept it for a year and now they're giving it to me. And so the tradition continues. You pass it along to somebody else. The 14-year-old fruitcake.
I think that may actually happen.
It actually could. I think that there's a strong possibility that that's not just a conspiracy theory, that could actually be a thing. Daryl in the chat room there says that there are some folks who now are doing fruitcake tosses in his locality right around Christmas time. X-Lady asks, is that like chunkin' pumpkins? Maybe it sort of is. But I'll tell you a quick ghost story as it relates to eggnog, okay? So it's probably one of my favorite holiday ghost stories. It was told to me by the American singer Ellis Paul. And yeah, Ellis Paul, who he's written some beautiful songs, just a great guy, a singer from Boston. Back when I worked in radio here in town, our general manager, Ken Salyer, he was such a fan of Ellis Paul, he and his wife, that they would get Ellis to come down once a year. He'd usually perform at the Grey Eagle here in town or something. And then he'd do a little performance or appearance on the radio. And so they asked me to come in because I'm a musician. And they were like, hey, Micah, you play guitar, so why don't you come in and help us interview Ellis Paul? So it was Joshua P. Warren,
yeah,
who was filling in for our Drive Time host, and me, and we were interviewing Ellis Paul, this famous singer and songwriter. And he was the nicest guy, and he was performing some songs on Air Force and things like that. And we asked him naturally, I mean, do you happen to have a ghost story or anything? He says, actually, yeah, it's a holiday ghost story. So he said, I had a friend named Vance, and I was in Boston, and I wanted to catch up with him. And he and I went out, and we were having eggnog, and it was right around the holidays. And he says, we're going to be having this holiday party later. Come on over and join us afterward. And so he says, sure, I'll come over. So they go to the holiday party, and they get there. And Vance's girlfriend and some of her friends had recently taken up a new hobby of playing with Ouija boards. They were playing with a Ouija board, and they said that there was a single entity that was constantly coming through. They said that she'd identified herself as Margaret Putnam, but that she kind of used this handle. She called herself Pug, P-U-G. Now, Ellis told me, he said, I was really, really skeptical of all this, but they'd get on this thing, and they would chat it up just like it was AOL Instant Messenger or AOL chat. Chat rooms, okay, for those internet archaeologists in the audience, you may not use these still, but some will remember back in the early days of America Online, they would have chat rooms where people would go in there.
AIM.
And you would have these chats with random people who would log in, and people would, and it was weird because, you know, these days, trolls, you know, I mean, the internet behaves an awful lot like a J.R.R. Tolkien novel. There are so many trolls at large. Back in those days, I would even get in the chat rooms. I don't remember that many trolls. People seemed to be really, I even had some downright mystical conversations with people in chat rooms back in the day. But anyway, Ellis said that them talking on the Ouija board was almost like, you know, an AOL chat room. And they would get in there and Pug would show up and they'd start asking questions and she would relate certain things. Now, being the skeptic, they said, Ellis, why don't you sit down over there? We're going to have our fingers on the planchette and you ask the questions and we'll see what Pug tells us. So he says, okay, well. So he asks, what was the last song I played last night in my set? And it spells out rain. And the last song he had played the night before in his set was a song called, like, Let It Rain. And he says, okay, well, what's the name of my manager? And it spells out Jermaine, which is the name of his manager, but it spells it wrong. His manager's name was spelled with a G, and it spelled it with a J. And he asked all these other questions, and he says, I mean, within about 5 minutes, you know, it became very evident to me that this thing knew the answer to everything I said. And he said, I had to go out of the room, lock myself in the bathroom for a few minutes, and just compose myself. He said it scared him so bad. Now, he said, I further wanted to look into this, and so I went downtown to the Hall of Records. I asked him, has Pug told you anything else about herself? And they said, yeah, she said that she was married to a doctor here in town back in the 1890s. So he goes down to City Hall, and he's looking up records, and he says, sure enough, he found a Margaret Putnam that was married to a doctor that lived right there in Boston. That was his story. That was his story. Make of it what you will. You know, sometimes, though, and I think, if anything, over the last few days, what we've learned is that sometimes some of our expectations, they may not always come to fruition, but surprises, I definitely think, happen nonetheless along the way. As with all things, I'm cautious, but I do remain open-minded. So there's a holiday ghost story. Interesting, if true. But I can certainly vouch for the fellow who told it to me. Now, when we come back, we'll wrap things up for this hour, and then it's going to be some UFO talk on the other side here on the Graylian Report. Broadcasting from the dark hills of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. Hey, a quick note, because I'd noticed some profanity over there on our YouTube page. That's right, we've got a YouTube page where we put up episodes of this program, and people were just cussing up a storm, Matt, because they were saying, well, I can't tell you exactly what they were saying. This is a family-friendly broadcast. But they were complaining about how long it took to get to the interviews on the program. Get to the interview already, they would say. Get to the interview. Okay, let me just be clear. We don't always, in fact, we very seldom do feature interviews because, oh, I don't know, every other program out there generally relies on interviews. I love the format of the shows that we do, where, again, Matt and I are sitting here and we're providing commentary. We do occasionally bring in guests who talk about whether it's a timely matter or an evergreen subject. But, you know, we do it our way. We do it how we want to. And I love how people go out there immediately looking for the interview. First of all, they don't seem to understand on YouTube, if we upload our shows, that it is a podcast. And this isn't for everybody. So anybody listening right now on YouTube, you know, don't take this the wrong way. I'm speaking to those who don't seem to understand what the show is that we're listening to right now together. We are all an active participant in, okay? So don't get angry if it takes us an hour to get to the interview, because usually how this format works is we do news in the first hour and then we do another subject-oriented hour during hour two. Sometimes there's a guest right there. We have to explain. Matt, doing it for 8 years now and we still have to explain ourselves. It's incredible. You know, there's a lot of breaking news right now, and I want to get to a couple of real quick headlines before we do our UFO stuff. These are late-breaking developments and things that are fresh off the press and so important to be talking about right now. First and foremost, there is a particular animal long thought to be extinct that has now been discovered, and it is still alive and well. Now, NewAtlas.com reports that once widespread across the deserts of inland Australia, the crest-tailed mulgara, a usual kind of, what's a marsupial, so you might say it's kind of like a possum or something. Well, I'll tell you the truth. Actually, this little creature, if you look at him, he looks kind of like a mix between a possum and maybe, I don't know, a ground squirrel, something like that. And they were thought to be wiped out by invasive rabbits, cats, and foxes. But this little carnivorous marsupial has not been seen in the state of New South Wales for a century. And now environment scientists from a university in Sydney have recently rediscovered the creature in the area, once again alive and well. It's long been maintained that there's another creature, often described as mysterious, but really it's not. It's a creature that existed. It was a little weird looking. I'm talking, of course, about the Tasmanian tiger. How many other animals are out there, incredibly wary, able to blend into their environments and remain off the grid, so to speak, at least for human eyes, for such a long time? And I mean, how long does it take for us to, I mean, get it through our thick skulls that there is plenty about this world that we have not yet discovered? And when it comes to that discussion about life, let me also just add some of the big news breaking within the last 2 hours. PhysOrg reporting on this, that the oldest fossils ever found to show life on Earth began before 3.5 billion years ago. You talk about a paradigm shift. We have talked about human origins and ancient history so much on this year because there has been so much going on. And I have spoken about this with so many people over the last few days. In fact, Ty Gilpin and I, we sat down, my philosopher friend, Ty, and Ty actually has his degree in philosophy from Nashville University. I always enjoy talking with him. And he said, you know, Micah, sometimes call me crazy, but I feel almost like there's a paradigm shift underway. And I said, look, no, I don't think that's crazy at all. I think a lot of people feel that. Ideas and attitudes are really changing about things with the number of discoveries and the way that information is reaching people. And as far as, again, the attitudes among, like, you know, the Kurzweils and the Ben Goetzels out there, you know, the artificial intelligence advocates, the singularitarians, the ones who are saying that there will be a point where there is a technological singularity and that beyond this point, we can't understand or conceive of what the future of humanity may end up being or what it will entail. I am fascinated by all this. And really, I mean, are we learning so much? Is there so much information? And is this going to be steadily supplemented in the years to come by artificial intelligence in a way that it fundamentally changes the way that we live on Earth, the way that we think about things, and how, I mean, again, we're getting like a taste of it right now. Let me come back to the story real quick, because again, I think the real big assessment is going to be in hour two, but researchers at UCLA and the University of Wisconsin-Madison have confirmed that microscopic fossils discovered in a nearly 3.5 billion year old piece of rock in Western Australia are the oldest fossils ever found and indeed the earliest direct evidence of life on this planet. Pin drop. That is
it's worthy of a pin drop.
It is.
And we've seen in the past couple of weeks, and we've also seen this kind of paradigm shift, this huge story about the exodus from Africa not being a mass exodus as we previously thought.
More like a slow trickle.
Yeah,
and then it went back. You know, initially we thought it was around 60,000 years ago that this began. They're pushing it back to 120,000 years ago. This study, as it relates to the oldest life on Earth, was published just today in the Proceedings of the National Academy of the Sciences, led by J. William Schopf, a professor of paleobiology at UCLA, as well as John W. Valley, professor of geoscience at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The study describes 11 microbial specimens from five separate taxa, linking their morphologies to chemical signatures that are characteristic of life. Some represent now extinct bacteria and microbes from a domain of life called archaea, while others are similar to microbial species that are still found today. But the findings also suggest how each may have survived on an oxygen-free planet. Once something that experts thought simply couldn't happen, and certainly not that long ago. Just look at that. And if there was life here much longer ago, and in what presumably would have been a fairly inhospitable environment, what does that tell us about life and its endurance, and also its origins? We're looking for the answers to human origins. We really need to think about where life on Earth itself comes from, maybe from someplace else. We'll touch on that when we return on the Graylian Report.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida. Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back. It is the second hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. So proud and privileged, I think, to be able to be your host on Monday nights here on the indomitable KGRARadio.com. Somehow still on the mainstreams, even though we are experiencing site difficulties. I think most people are still able to access things. I know my site is down right now. After all the work that we've done behind the scenes to make sure that everything was up and running and good, I don't know. I have to see what's going on. I'm not going conspiracy or anything, by the way. I'm just saying it's very unusual that we're having stream difficulties with KGRIRadio.com. All my sites go down, including Graylian Report, during the Graylian Report live broadcast. I tell you, there are moments that will shake one's skepticism, Matt.
Maybe. Just a little bit.
just a little bit. Just a little. Not that much. Only a minuscule amount. Hey, by the way, if you are interested in this program, what we do, what we talk about, and of course the information that we provide, head over to Graylian Report. Well, of course, by the time podcast listeners are hearing this, the site will, I guarantee you, be back up. GraylianReport.com/X. That's where you can subscribe and you can get weekly additional shows. The monthly special known as Graylian Enigmas, which we have postponed ever so slightly just in advance of the Christmas holiday. I always try to release that show a little closer to Christmas because it is the Christmas ghost story of M.R. James.
And who doesn't love those? I love them.
They're really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did the Ash Tree a few years ago. And keep in mind that if you're new to Graylian X, you can go back through the archives and enjoy all of those past episodes of Graylian Enigmas, all of the Christmas specials that feature the M.R. James stories. You could have a whole marathon at this point because I think we've got three or four of them in there already. And don't forget all the other episodes where we've looked at famous UFO cases. We'll look from time to time at the fiction of authors of yore, like my very favorite, the old man himself, H.P. Lovecraft. And also be sure, as you're tuning in, we don't take time off around the holidays. You know, our ad agency asked me the other day, please, guys, get us your 2018 schedule so that we know what days you will and will not be on the air. And I said, it's very simple, okay? Every week, once a week, we always do a show. It's kind of like what old Dale Cooper said. Every day, once a day, give yourself a present. Don't plan it. Just let it happen. And for me, it's that damn fine cup of coffee. And as much as we enjoy that Sumatran black gold, the dark liquid of the morning ritual, I know that you guys probably enjoy these podcasts. So we don't keep you waiting. We put them out every week. And in fact, you're always every week going to get exactly what we tell you we're going to put out there. We never miss a week on this show. May come out a little later or a little earlier, week to week, depending on what's going on, but there's always a show. Now, next week, of course, we are going to be on the air, as we always are, our final show of this year. And there will be a big announcement about some very interesting projects that I'm involved with that involve some players that you have already heard from and about on this show. I'm going to be making a big announcement next week about something to look forward to. If you guys are fans of archaeology, ancient history, and the like, well, there's going to be some really good news next week. So much to be on the lookout for and look forward to. A little Christmas presents to you guys out there in the Grillian listening audience.
Do I have to wait to hear the news? You didn't even tell me we were going to have news next week.
You got to wait just like everybody else.
Okay.
Guys got to keep some things secret, Matt. Now, what had been kept secret until this weekend was the fact that there is a UFO study group and that this had been essentially operated under the purview of the Pentagon. Now, I'm going to refer to a Reuters report from just earlier today. The Pentagon admitted Saturday that its long-secret UFO investigation program did exist. But it said the program ended in 2012 when U.S. defense officials shifted attention and money to other programs. But whether the, and this is what it was called, the Advanced Aviation Threat Identification Program. Otherwise, we might transform that, Matt, into a very convenient acronym, ATIP. Whether the ATIP has continued to investigate UFO sightings since its money dried up 5 years ago could be an unexplained phenomena in itself. Many have been asking that question. And of course, Reuters was probing for answers in the wake of a New York Times report issued on Saturday, which discussed this program, which the sole express intention of this program was to investigate sightings of unidentified flying objects or UFOs. It ran between 2007 and 2012 with $22 million a year in funding, which was secretly tucked away in U.S. Defense Department budgets. Now, for more about the kind of things that are slipped into Defense Department budgets and emergency war spending bills and all kinds of things like this, you might head over and check out middletheory.com, because we talked a bit about that this week and some things that were slipped into some legislation over the last few years. And we touched on this UFO thing, too. But the initial funding for this program came mostly at the request of a former senator and one of some prestige and renowned. That's Harry Reid himself, the Nevada Democrat, long known for his interest in space phenomena. Yet according to its backers, the program, they say, remains in existence, and officials continue to investigate UFO episodes brought to their attention by service members, according to the New York Times. Now, the Pentagon was not clear about whether this UFO program continues to hover somewhere in the vast universe of the U.S. defense establishment. The Defense Department takes seriously all threats and potential threats to our people, our assets, and our mission, and takes action whenever credible information is developed. This according to Laura Ochoa, who was a Pentagon spokeswoman, and this reported by Reuters. What is less in doubt right now is that former Senator Harry Reid's enthusiasm for UFOs and his role in launching the Pentagon initiative to identify advanced aviation threats. He, and this, again, reported, if you've talked to Harry Reid for more than 60 seconds, then it's least surprising that he loves UFOs and got an earmark to study them. This according to his own spokeswoman, Kristen Orthman. Or as Reid himself said in a tweet, the truth is out there, seriously. He, in fact, said more than that, and maybe we'll look a little bit at what Harry Reid had to say. And what's really fascinating to me is actually looking not only at, like, for instance, the Twitter thread after he tweets about this. The New York Times reports, Harry Reid tweets about it and says, I'm not ashamed, I'm not embarrassed, I'm proud of taking government money and putting it behind the study of these phenomena, whatever they are.
Yeah, he said it was one of the greatest things he had done in his tenure as a public official, which I'm not positive about, but I think that's a grandiose claim to make. But
well, you know, depends on what it is. I would actually say if there is indeed a phenomena, and if indeed we are coming close to understanding or at very least acknowledging it, and if certain technologies are able to assist us in doing so, and if this leads to certain paradigm shifts, I always, man, without question, okay, I always maintain a concern about the way that taxpayer money is used and whether it's being used for and by the people, constitutionally and otherwise. But if indeed innovations or new discoveries of great scientific importance result from this, it very well may be one of the best things that he ever did. That is yet to be proven. That will remain to be seen is what we have to deal with right now. Now, on political lines, and maybe we'll talk a little more about that later, Matt, but it's funny because I'm used to seeing, again, let's say liberal media outlets like New York Times, they're going to downplay this kind of a thing. But now,
well, I think most are in general.
Most in
now,
general.
We have seen in the past, I remember years ago when I was working at FYE texting you because Fox News was carrying a Bigfoot story on live television.
Yeah. Oh, so, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
And which is funny because, again, you might say Fox News is more traditionally going to be open to carrying fringe-worthy stories. Now, what's interesting is this ends up being reported, and the association with Harry Reid seems to carry some legitimacy. New York Times, Washington Post, Reuters, Politico, all reporting on it rather matter-of-factly. National Review, an extremely traditionally conservative publication, criticizing.
Oh, yeah.
Not only Harry
Reid. Scathing.
Yeah, which is interesting because you see that, unfortunately, those political biases on either side, if a subject can be weaponized, they will use it to their advantage in order to do so.
Well, they have to. That's the current climate, I feel like. I mean, I wouldn't say they have to in a broad sense, but the current climate dictates that they will, and they should,
which,
I guess.
Which is why I said, and see, look, politics, and even geopolitics, is inevitably a part of this conversation, which is why we have to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And why we, as newsmen, have to report on it. Matt and I talk about this often, that we report on things that are in the news because if we're behind a microphone, that's what we do. That's what I've done for the better part of the last 12 years, and I'm going to continue to do on this program. But the bigger picture, what I'm afraid many of the political ideologues out there who are using this and its, again, association, just the UFO subject with fringe ideologies and silly belief systems in their minds, by using that as weapon or fodder for launching attacks against their political opponents, they are fundamentally, completely, and unapologetically, I think, missing the point. The broader point being that at the end of the day, yeah, we can talk about taxpayer money. We can talk about all this. Yes, we should. Yes, we will. But there also may be some very credible dialogue occurring right now as it relates to unexplained phenomena, which, according to officials who have studied it, as we're about to see, have said may appear to be of technological origin, but which does not seem to be associated explicitly with any known country on Earth. In other words, this is advanced technological phenomena which we cannot account for. Think on that for a moment. I mean, seriously, think about that. An advanced technological phenomena, something which is capable of maneuverability in our skies, which we can't account for, which we can't attribute to any world power, let alone our own. It could be our own. It could be somebody else's. We don't know. And that's the point. There are more questions than answers, but we're having a credible dialogue about this. I hope that doesn't get lost in the midst of dialogue that resorts to, you know, typical mudslinging and political hubris. That's my big concern.
Well, before the show, you had even said, and you said you didn't like using this term, but I think it's a perfect term. This is a very nuanced story that's coming out.
I don't mind the term.
I know you don't. There are a lot of layers to this. We've touched on like five different aspects of the same story in the past 2 minutes, you know, and we haven't even delved into them.
We could have
a show on each portion of the story.
We could, or we could have done what everybody else in the world's going to do, and that's, you know, put together a panel discussion and get a couple of people who've written books about UFOs on, have them talk about this. The one guy,
what's this mean, Micah?
and in truth and in fairness, I'm going to be participating in a few of those, and I don't mind that, and I'm not criticizing people who did, but that's why we're not doing it. You know, Matt and I, we're going to sit here, we're going to talk about the nuances, we're going to look at the politics, we're going to look at, again, the actual congressional aspect of this, and also the constitutionality of decisions that were made. We're going to look at Tom DeLonge. We're going to look at some of the other players like Bob Bigelow, and we're going to absolutely, at the end of the day, ask ourselves, what do we know about the alleged phenomena that was being studied? That is at the heart of the matter, and it will remain as such. I want to read from the Politico now. Okay, the Pentagon, at the direction of Congress a decade ago, quietly set up a multi-million dollar program to investigate what are popularly known as UFOs. The unidentified aerial phenomena claimed to have been seen by pilots and other military personnel appeared vastly more advanced than those in American or foreign arsenals. In some cases, they maneuvered so unusually and so fast that they seemed to defy the laws of physics, according to multiple sources directly involved in or briefed on the effort and a review of unclassified Defense Department and congressional documents.
And, you know, the New York Times and Politico did post this video of this UFO.
Right.
So I will go ahead, just so everybody's aware, I'll go ahead and put the video up on the Graylian Twitter feed.
Yeah, tweet that out for us. And in fact, actually, there's a really great article in the show notes from Rolling Stone that features both of the two that have been released by the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is Tom DeLonge's organization, which features, we talked about remote viewing a few weeks ago, and we focused more on Russell Targ at that point, but his colleague, Hal Puthoff, who had also worked with the Central Intelligence Agency on developing remote viewing for practical applications. Hal Puthoff is now a member of Tom DeLonge's organization, which we have been critical of, I think, in a measured way. Again, we're always cautiously open-minded about these kind of things, but there have been some red flags with Tom DeLonge, and then there have been some promising things. The fact that this happened this weekend and that it was managed and presented by the media in the way that it was actually may be a few brownie points for Tom DeLonge. And the fact that, again, the individual who was in charge of this Pentagon UFO study group, Luis Elizondo, is now also a member of the To the Stars Academy. So while people are out there naysaying and picking on Tom DeLonge, maybe Tom isn't always the most well-spoken and eloquent in terms of his own personal expressions and beliefs about this, but the people in the group that he has assembled, you can no longer deny as being key players in this affair as it unfolds. Now, again, one possible theory the Politico reported behind the unexplained incidents, according to a former congressional staffer who described the motivations behind the program, was that a foreign power, perhaps the Chinese or the Russians, had indeed developed next-generation technologies that could threaten the United States. They are looking at a lot of different angles here. Was this China or Russia trying to do something, or has some propulsion system we're not familiar with, according to a former staffer who spoke with Politico, but only on condition of anonymity? The revelation of the program could give a credibility boost to UFO theories and theorists who have long pointed to public accounts by military pilots and others describing phenomena that defy obvious explanation. And one of those was reported by the New York Times and later featured in an ABC News report. We have audio.
We are back with that newly revealed UFO program at the Pentagon. The government has spent millions of dollars investigating UFOs like this one right there. It was spotted by Navy pilots. And Nick Watt has a closer look at the program.
Just one of many alleged sightings investigated by the secret $22 million UFO unit run from the Pentagon.
It's roasted.
The real-life X-Files.
I've seen things that I cannot deny.
Here's another.
Yeah, because that really brings credibility to the coverage. Yeah, that we put X-Files sound clips in there and play the X-Files theme and say ad nauseum, the truth is out there. I wish they would just stop that!
We always have to associate everything with pop culture. I think it makes it easier to digest.
It is, and it does, and we even do that on this program when we evoke Doctor Who talking about time travel and space-time physics and things like that and various other things, and Dale Cooper and, you know, D.B. Cooper or whoever else. I mean, we do it too, and it's fun, and I know everybody enjoys it, but I'm just so tired of the X-Files reference every time they have to report on UFOs.
It's pandering. I will agree with you.
It's unimaginative. Anyway, getting back to the audio.
Pilots describe as a 40-foot-long tic-tac 100 miles off the California coast.
I have never seen anything in my life that had the performance, the acceleration. Keep in mind, this thing had no wings.
Commander David Fravor was piloting an F-A-18 on a training mission that day in 2004.
And it's moving around, left, right, forward, back. The radar immediately starts getting jammed. All of a sudden, it takes off.
No aircraft that we know of can fly at those speeds, maneuver like that, and looks like that.
I think it was not from this world. I just know it was really impressive, really fast, and I would like to fly it.
The Pentagon telling ABC News the Advanced Aviation Threat Identification Program ended in the 2012 timeframe. It was determined there were other higher priority issues that merited funding.
So we always joke, maybe it was trying to communicate with something under the water. You know, I've seen Star Trek with the whales. I don't know if it was alien life, but I will say that in an infinite universe with multiple galaxies that we know of, that if we're the only planet with life, it's a pretty lonely universe.
Now, there are often rational explanations, but Commander Fravor hasn't heard one yet for his sighting. And George and Paula, according to sources quoted in the New York Times, the military still listens to soldiers and sailors and airmen, still investigates what might be out there.
I don't know, that visual, I'm not positive that it's not the Millennium Falcon I saw. Star Wars yesterday, yesterday, and it kind of looks like it rotating there in the sky, Nick, so that's my little theory.
Wow. I mean, really, come on. It's like, how much more can we just cram in there? Some of the other reporting, though, has been a little bit, well, I think it's more interesting, and I think it's also a little more reputable. For instance, we do have this interview where CBS spoke with Leslie Kane talking about this the day that it all dropped. And I think that truly Leslie Kane is arguably the most respectable journalist who has been championing the UFO subject for years now. We have audio.
The Air Force formed Project Blue Book for three basic purposes. First, to determine that there was no threat to our national security. Second, to preclude technological surprise. And third, and probably most important, to prove the existence of UFOs.
That was a clip from the late 1970s TV show Project Blue Book, based on an Air Force program that investigated UFO sightings. Project Blue Book ended in 1969. 4 decades later, we're learning about another government program that remained largely a secret. According to the New York Times, the program produced documents that describe sightings of aircraft that seemed to move at very high velocities with no visible signs of propulsion, or that hovered with no apparent means of lift. Joining me now is Leslie Kane, one of the co-writers of that New York Times article and author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Leslie, we appreciate you being here to talk to us about this. What more can you tell us about this Pentagon program? What did it find?
Well, the program has been in operation since 2007, and it's been secret until now. And it studied about 10 to 12 different incidences a year that involve military aircraft encountering these objects that can't be explained. And basically, they characterize them as the way you did. Mm-hmm. They're objects that they can't explain how they can. They move incredibly fast. They'll hover and take a sudden right angle turn, incredible velocities that we could never withstand if any living creature was in them. So they observe behaviors that seem to be technology that we don't have on this planet. I mean, that's what we're stuck with.
And so there was a pretty sizable budget for this program. What did they find?
Well, I mean, basically what they did with that budget is a lot of different research to try to document what was going on, to try to understand the physics behind how the objects, you know, move around. Mm-hmm. And then to just keep records of what they were observing. But they haven't been able to find what they are, where they're from, or anything like that. It's a process of investigating incidences and then trying to collect as much data as you can.
So who was behind securing the funding for the Pentagon to be able to do this sort of work? And I guess what was the logic behind it? What were they hoping to accomplish with this?
Well, I mean, Senator Harry Reid was behind the funding. He with a couple of colleagues, Senator Inouye and Senator Stevens, in 2007, 2009, he was able to get funding appropriated for the program, and it ended up being about $22 million, and they had contractors that helped do the research.
But this was kept a secret. I mean, nobody knew about this.
It was kept a secret. It was kept a secret.
Why?
And nobody even knew that the program existed, and in fact, lots of people in the Pentagon don't even know it exists. So it's barely been kept quiet because the information is very, very sensitive. And they felt that, you know, there's also other countries that might be working on the same thing. So there's a sense of wanting to keep this information to ourselves. But a lot of people believe that it should be made public, and that's what we're dealing with right now.
Now, there are a lot of people out there who say that this might be a waste of taxpayer dollars to be searching for UFOs and investigating aliens and that sort of thing. What have people said, people you've talked to, what have they said about that?
Everybody has different opinions, and it's not about investigating aliens. It's just about investigating a documented phenomenon that has been observed, that has been seen on videos, and trying to figure out what it is. That's basically what it is. Nobody's claiming that they're aliens or that they're extraterrestrials. So here we're dealing with something that could be potential threat because it's a technological craft that we don't understand and we don't know where it comes from and how it does what it does. That's the reason to study it.
All right. It's an interesting read. I read your article, and it sort of raises some questions and answers a few others and then raises some more. But
it raises a lot of questions, and there's a lot we don't know. That's the whole point.
Indeed.
I think that is the whole point.
I have to say, there's so much to unpack here. So I don't really know where to start, so I'm just going to dive in. I have to wonder, though, there's so many voices coming out of the news media right now regarding this, you know, program, and Harry Reid saying, you know, it's a great thing. I'm really happy with what we've done. You have Tom DeLonge, who hasn't really come out about this specifically.
Yeah, but interestingly, he hasn't had all that much to say.
Which I find incredibly odd. But
also kind of admirable, because he's not jumping up and down going, ha, look at me, y'all. He seems to be willing to kind of be behind the scenes and allow the people he's working with to do the work and to present this information.
But then in the Politico article, they had quotes from a former staff member who preferred to remain anonymous, but the two quotes in the article were, after a while, the consensus was we really couldn't find anything of substance. Separate quote was, they produced reams of paperwork. After all of that, there was really nothing that we could find. It all pretty much dissolved from that reason alone, and the interest level was losing steam. We only did it a couple years.
See, that's what's interesting. That's exactly what happened with Project Blue Book, although it lasted longer. The University of Colorado UFO Project determined, well, I mean, there are 700 or so, again, incidents involving something, but there was never any determination exactly as to what they were, and therefore they said we're not gaining anything in terms of science and advancement.
Well, that's the thing I have to wonder, and we keep bringing up Project Blue Book, but that's not the only, you know, government project that's tried to address this phenomenon. You have the Brookings Report, the Condon Committee, the Project Blue Book, Project Grudge, Project Sign, Project Silverbug.
Yeah.
I mean, most of these are Cold War era programs.
Yeah.
But some of them do go into the 80s, allegedly.
Yeah.
But
we're also just talking about U.S.-based projects. Then keep in mind, again,
many more all over the world.
Yeah, Nick Pope, of course, was still involved with the UFO desk at MI6, or MI5, I guess.
Yeah.
And no doubt there are, well, I know this for a fact, and in truth, there are investigative committees based within governments of other countries all around the world that are still presently actively engaged in this, but they don't see it as some sort of a fringe subject. They look at it as a legitimate science endeavor, a scientific endeavor to try and understand some sort of phenomena in our midst for which we cannot fully account.
But do you really think, and I want to get excited about this, you sent me the message Saturday night, and I was like, whoa, this is huge, and I actually was out at the bar and whisked myself away to one corner and just started reading all the you know, articles about it. So at the time, there was only Politico and New York Times, but I wanted to find out as much as possible. And I really want this, of course, to be a disclosure, but we have had a lot of programs, and each time we have these programs and the information made public, it's kind of like, you know, zero-sum game. We didn't find anything.
No, that's always what happens.
So I really wonder if this is going to be the same thing, if there's going to be much ado about nothing. I hope not, and I maintain faith that there will be something that grows out of this. As you said, those two videos that I just put up on the Graylian Twitter are interesting videos. I mean, I had a hard time pegging what exactly I was looking at, and I still haven't.
What's interesting about that is that the Chilean Air Force had released a similar video previously, and there are plenty of other videos like that have appeared over the years. The only thing that seems to make this one any different, or this pair of videos, is that they seem to have been released in conjunction with a former Pentagon official coming forward, Luis Elizondo, saying that he was involved with all this. Multiple news agencies, which obviously were tipped off about this, probably by two of the stars themselves, or those working with them, they go after this, and they get a great, I mean, whoever managed this in terms of the actual release of information to the media did so masterfully.
Agreed.
They did so masterfully, but will there be all kinds of pomp and circumstance and then very little in the way of actual nuts and bolts information which we use to further our knowledge of this phenomena? It could very well be that. Now, and this is one thing that a few people have pointed out, but I have heard no one else talk about, except for on the Bad UFOs blog, Robert Schaefer, a colleague of mine and a very skeptical one, had noted that there were three UFO videos mentioned. Tom DeLonge and his people have released two. So one thing I'm wondering is, if they've mentioned three but released two, why are they sitting on number three? Are they holding off on the release of one so as to perhaps have something else, so that if, you know, interest starts to die down,
a smoking gun or something.
It may not even be a smoking gun. It very well may just be that they released two right off the bat. Elizondo goes out. He's appeared within the context of multiple different interviews, reports, all different kinds of statements have been offered. He appeared on the New York Times Daily podcast today. I've got a couple of audio soundbites from that that we want to talk about where he speaks on this phenomena himself. And I think it's very important to get his perspective on that. One of our listeners, by the way, tipped me off about this, and a hat tip to them, because against you guys out there who send along emails and who write in and who tell me about these kind of things and bring these kind of things to our attention so that we can report on them for a broader audience. And also, I want to give props to somebody tweeting at me, Dan James, my good pal from Down Under, who tweets at me, who's to say some of the technology we're looking at isn't from some Tomorrowland-style organization who have never wanted government interference from any country, and so they just get on with it, and they research with or without research being turned into a weapon or being confiscated. That might sound like a silly idea, but again, go back in the archives and listen to an episode that we did, which is called "Bankers of the Breakaway Civilization" here on Gray Alien Report.
That was what I was about to bring up. Actually, was the breakaway civilization.
Well, angle. And what's funny is again that was an idea first promoted by Richard Dolan, but I've heard everybody from, again, my pal Walter Bosley to Alex Jones on his radio show talk about that concept. Now, D-Man will tell you he doesn't necessarily endorse that idea, but it was a concept that he looked at because I think Richard, like myself, is willing to entertain different alternatives without giving himself to one of them. If he gives himself to anything, I think Richard probably is still more in the UFOs or alien camp. And I hope I'm not trying to misquote him or anything. I would just say that I think that Richard would hold that position maintains a justified amount of evidence, at least according to UFO advocates like Richard. Now, I'm a little less willing to give myself to that. I stand in the more agnostic area with this. And if I had to guess, I would actually say that probably Dan is spot on in the idea that, again, borrowing from Richard's own idea that he never married himself to about a breakaway civilization. And I think, actually, let me just clarify, too. One of the things that Richard said about that prevented him from giving himself to that idea was the fact he said that, of course, if we're talking about a advanced technology, you got to have funding behind that. And he said, to me, it seems highly unlikely that such a technology could emanate from anything outside of a government and nonetheless have the funding to be able to do so. So where is the impetus for the idea that a funding mechanism could exist outside of a governmental source? Many would say it's impossible. But again, I would say if you want to see how and where it could come from, of all places, if you go on Netflix and you watch the show Breaking Bad, those who have watched Breaking Bad and the character Gus, okay, he seems like this mild-mannered guy. He operates a little restaurant. And as a side business, he has a secret underground methamphetamine facility where Walter White is employed to cook meth all the time. And this, it is later inferred, is a funding mechanism behind some sort of a multinational organization that has ties to Germany. They don't go into depth in the program about what this is all about, but it got me thinking. I was like, my gosh, just think about this. You know, if ever there were something that could be used, if carried out and done carefully and covertly, to fund something like this, that kind of thing would absolutely do it. And as fairy tale and strange as that idea seems, I mean, it would explain, it would be a hypothetical scenario that could be used to explain a funding mechanism for some multinational extra-governmental organization. So I don't think that ideas like a breakaway civilization are crazy by any means. And when Dan right there tweets about a Tomorrowland-style organization, again, I would say this too. We can say that whatever we observe of this phenomena seems so unlike known technologies on Earth that therefore it must be something else. But then again, as our astronomers point our telescopes out there and we're looking constantly for life out there and we're not finding it yet, but we feel that every day we're getting closer and yet something is right here in our midst capable of advanced maneuverability. I mean, all kinds of interesting facets of the UFO phenomena. Is it not more likely, at least, that this phenomena is something that does emanate from here on Earth? Because while we are searching for life out there, we know that life exists here on Earth. Whether it's intelligent or not is another question. That's all I'm saying. Now, again, on the New York Times Daily podcast today, they spoke with Elizondo, and they had some very interesting exchanges with him, and I found this extremely interesting because, again, some of the things that he says about this, I'll just let you guys be the judge. We have that audio.
Can you just explain the name of the program?
Sure. Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program.
Hey, why threat?
Well, in the Department of Defense, keep in mind, the name of the department is the Department of Defense. It's a national security organization. Its job is to identify and, if necessary, neutralize any threats to U.S. national security. Mm-hmm. It is a very significant mission of the department. So typically, missions in the department involve fighting wars and identifying threats, whether they be chemical threats, biological threats, missile threats, you name it, any threat du jour, right? In this particular case, advanced aerospace threats.
This is a program to try to identify...
Yes.
UFOs.
It's a program to investigate sightings of UFOs, particularly among military service members, pilots, Navy pilots, Air Force pilots, and to chronicle them and also to look at the technology involved in some of the objects in the hopes of eventually being able to reverse engineer the things that these people believe that they have seen.
These are very, I believe, very compelling videos.
About these videos, again, you can, if you go to the Graylian Report Twitter, and also my Twitter at Micah Hanks, I've retweeted Matt's tweets from the Graylian account there, but you will be able to see these videos. And also, if you go to the original New York Times article, you can find them there. But the New York Times continued their discussion with Elizondo, and you're going to hear right toward the end of this clip some rather breathtaking assertions made about this phenomenon.
So what this particular video demonstrates is an object otherwise referred to as a Tic Tac by some of the pilots, a small white craft. To the untrained observer, it might not look like anything but a blurry little dot.
Is that why it's called a Tic Tac? It literally looks like a Tic Tac?
It literally looks like a Tic Tac, yes. It literally is a object that has no flight surfaces, no apparent type of thrust mechanism, something that is hovering, something that is demonstrating extreme maneuverability, sudden accelerations beyond the G-forces of what we would consider, you know, healthy acceleration, and velocities that are very, very compelling to us.
So in other words, it's moving in a way that does not resemble anything human-made.
Right. Something that would be, for example, sitting in a complete hover and then all of a sudden darts off screen at an incredible velocity that if you don't know what you're looking at, it may look like the screen just kind of pans away. But in reality, that's not the case. What you're looking at is an object that's moving off of the field of view at a very far distance away at an incredible velocity.
And what do you make of that?
Well, speaking to you, not as someone from the Department of Defense, I think it's very curious. I would submit to you, I haven't seen anything that can do that. And I think many people who've witnessed this would agree.
Mm-hmm. So these videos are just what's been declassified. I understand you can't talk about what is classified, but is this just a small percentage of what this program has documented and collected and seen?
Yes.
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 Just a small percentage of what they've documented and seen. What is represented in these videos that have been released by To the Stars Academy is only a small percentage of what has been documented. Again, not just documented, but seen and reported. Presumably, in other words, they say that there is other unreleased information maintained by governments that is indicative of a reality behind whatever said phenomena is being discussed here. On Middle Theory today, I asked McNonymous about this, and he says, you know, one thing that we can certainly say at this point is that it's no longer blurry pictures taken on flip phones. He says, finally, we've got very advanced cameras trained on these things, and we have video evidence of that. And you know what's interesting about that, Matt, is that with the advanced cameras, the FLIR systems, you know, the tracking capabilities of these advanced camera systems, the videos still look blurry and indistinct.
I was thinking that when I was watching them the other night. Now, this all, what you had said here, by the way, it does seem to mimic. I've been looking for any statements from DeLong to the media. Because actually on his Twitter, he hasn't said it. He's retweeted a bunch of stuff, but he hasn't really said anything. He has been tight-lipped, but he told the New York Daily News yesterday that revelations like the Times investigation are only the tip of the spear. That's the only quote I can find from him.
He is, and perhaps admirably so, remaining tight-lipped about this, which I think shows a unexpected measure of control, poise, maturity on his part. Which, again, I'm not in any way attacking Tom DeLong. I'm merely saying that I think a lot of people have, including Joe Rogan, having had him on his show, they're like, you know, look, this guy, I'm not really impressed with the things that that he said so far.
No, I certainly was not.
Now, I'm not saying me again. I'm paraphrasing Joe Rogan. But I, again, like with all things, I withhold judgment on Tom DeLonge until I see what he has. He has said an awful lot for a long time. We're finally starting to see some things. You can't say that this is just something and he's going to take credit for it. I mean, this is obviously directly related to the To the Stars Academy and the announcement that they made and the people who are working directly with this. So, I mean, again, I'm actually impressed at this point, but I still think that it could be like what you said, Matt, where there's going to be a big storm of media attention and then it just kind of dies down and we don't really have any new information or data with which to work. All we know is that purportedly, according to Elizondo, there is more data, but that is not something the public will be able to get its hands on anytime soon.
Well, and I take that back. That wasn't the only quote from DeLonge. He also said, all the things that people have heard about and seen are the first step of 20. So he's been talking about this kind of program to disseminate information, that it's kind of a little bit at a time here. We're going to release this. He alluded to it on the Joe Rogan program quite a bit, but now it seems we have a definite number. There are 20 steps to his program.
But if that's the case and this is step number one, okay, you got my attention. I will say that. And I know a lot of people are still raging on Tom DeLonge and saying, can we please get back to this conversation, the real conversation, and not this BS that Tom DeLonge and his buddies are talking about. Again, you have to recognize this, at least for what it is. Very seldom do we have several mainstream media outlets report on the UFO subject without and allowing at least for a few of the X-Files references and the silly quotes and things and the cross-cultural, pop-cultural references. This has been well-managed in the sense that the media has not just had a field day with it. They have been responsibly reporting on it and treating it as though it is a real news item. And one, yes, that according to Elizondo and others, they refer to as a potential threat. Now, you'd ask me, by the way, is Tom DeLonge, is he wrong to refer to this as being a non-threatening technology where his peers apparently refer to this as being something that could potentially be threatening?
Well, I think there's a lot of language that there's a lot of disparity between the language the two parties use.
Right.
You know, Harry Reid says, you know, we don't know what it is, but we need to figure it out. DeLonge says, we know what it is.
Yeah,
we just need to let you know in 20 steps.
That's where we need to rein in on Tom a little.
Yeah.
Although I think
both party, I you have to wonder why the disparity happens, especially if these are two parties, two individuals that are in the same party on this, in the same boat and trying to disseminate the same information.
I wonder if Tom DeLonge and Harry Reid ever had any interactions.
I don't know. We know about Podesta. We know Reid and Podesta are fairly closely affiliated. So
yeah, they really are. I mean,
it's not a far jump to make.
It's not. I didn't know about Harry Reid until New York Times broke this story on Saturday. But I will say this, that again, you know, John Podesta in the middle, I thought it was rather telling that Podesta in the middle of a contentious election year, presidential election year, that he would make time to meet with Tom DeLonge and apparently Major General William McCaslin from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, overseeing the science divisions of the U.S. Air Force. And that, of course, this is presumably the scientist who is working with Tom DeLonge in his endeavors right now. I mean, this is extremely interesting to me that ever would have happened. And I do think that, in truth, in my opinion, what they were actually doing is that they were actually banking on what they perceived at the time as being the inevitability of Hillary Clinton's win. They thought that it was inevitable at that time that Hillary Clinton would win the election, in my opinion, and therefore they were banking on that, and they were planning to proceed with this information and the release of this information probably in conjunction with her election, knowing that she would be a candidate who had favorable attitudes toward UFOs. When she did not win the election, and when the other unforeseen happened, which was that WikiLeaks compromised some of what Tom DeLonge and To the Stars was, you know, working on through the Podesta leaks, those indeed may have been setbacks, as DeLonge said that they were. So it's interesting to see that this is all still coming about, but I wonder, in truth, what would have happened had it indeed been a different political environment and there had indeed been a different elected official in the occupancy of the Oval Office.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what are you? What who's tweeting?
So Podesta's tweeting about this, and he's hashtagging To the Stars.
Oh,
by the way, yeah. And his two most recent tweets are about this subject, and he hashtags To the Stars each time.
Interesting. What does he say?
Let's see here. I just went over to Harry Reid to see if he had maybe said anything more recently than the quotes we had read earlier, but it doesn't appear so. John Podesta says, Commander Fravor, I want to fly one. I just want to fly one. And it's an interview, two Navy airmen and the object that accelerated like nothing I've ever seen before, from the New York Times. And he also said about the initial New York Times article, lift the veil. Thanks, at Senator Reed. The truth is out there. Hashtag the truth is out there. More X-Files. Hashtag to the stars.
Also, Nick Pope, a former government employee under the British government who studied UFOs, he has tweeted recently, actually this was 15 hours ago, but still recently, my time on the Ministry of Defense's UFO project was 1991 to 1994, so while I have no direct knowledge of the Pentagon's Advanced Aviation Threat Identification Program, and that running again between 2007 and 2012, I know about such programs more generally, and I'm happy to share unclassified insights with journalists. So again, there are plenty of people who have worked in government who have studied this and who do perceive it as being evidence of some kind of phenomena, with whether or not this is indeed an alien technology that we're dealing with. Now, one final thing. Again, Matt, we should probably just talk about it, at least on the fiscal side of things, for a moment. There is the inescapable reality of the fact that taxpayer dollars were being sent with only apparently three senators that knew about this.
Yes.
To Bob Bigelow of Bigelow Aerospace, who, again, has been referred to rather dismissively by certain skeptics as a UFO nut. Oh, yeah, that's right. Resort to ad hominem to get your point across. Intellectual dishonesty. I'm sorry. But at the end of the day, the important takeaway from all this really is, perhaps in part, that, yeah, there is some serious discussion going on about an alleged technology. But then again, is there what some would be calling black budget or black money, you know, going into the hands of people like Bob Bigelow, and what's he doing with it? Again, Robert Schaefer over on the Bad UFOs blog, that was, and it's a very good point he raises. What is the question? Question is, that money was sent to Bob Bigelow. What did he do with all of it? We know, of course, that he outsourced to MUFON, our friends in the Mutual UFO Network, and that he was trying to obtain additional information like that. But this is fascinating to me because, again, in addition, and this is the thing, everybody's talking about the Pentagon, you know, Luis Elizondo and the Pentagon's UFO research team. Well, the other side of this, though, is that, and what Harry Reid was involved with, was funneling money to Bob Bigelow, who was carrying out subcontracted independent operations where he was subcontracting UFO researchers in MUFON and other groups, and he was doing civilian-based UFO observations. Where is the data? What was the money used for? Do we have federal oversight for any of this?
Well, I've been asking a lot of these questions over the past 24 hours, and I think they are important to ask, especially when you look in the context of time. This started in 2008. We're coming out of the Great Recession, or not even coming out of the Great Recession. We're in the middle of the Great Recession, right?
The other Great Recession.
And, yeah, we're spending $22 million, which is not much money. I will admit that it's not much money. And honestly, I don't feel that Bob Bigelow would have misused that money. I think he believes in the project enough. But we did use $22 million of taxpayers' dollars over the course of 3 years to fund a project that was amply funded by Bigelow himself. Since the mid-90s, he has spent $500 million on his own personal pet space projects, getting satellites and these balloon thing, like,
he's got a finger in so many pies, yeah, you can't
it's
keep
weird.
Track of, yeah,
but everything. $500 million there. He's spent millions on researching or using MUFON and other groups to research independently. Is this really the best use of taxpayers' dollars, especially when you only have three senators backing this project and nobody else knows about it, really?
Yeah, again, there are a lot of questions that need to be. I'm not seeing the mainstream ask any of these questions. And you go to Bob Bigelow and you say, do you think that we'll find evidence of aliens? And again, as he told 60 Minutes, it's right under our noses. It's right here. We don't have to look out there. They're right here. So
he is an unabashed believer, and I do think we have to skeptically approach that, but not to the point that a lot of skeptics have. I found an article about Bigelow from several years ago, I think 09, in the Skeptical Inquirer, where they just tear him apart. And honestly, Esquire reported on this today. They tear the whole story apart. It is so dismissive, it is absurd. And when you have names like the New York Times, you have Politico, you have Harry Reid, you have John Podesta, it's one after another for Esquire, of all places, to be incredibly dismissive, for Skeptical Inquirer to be dismissive of these people. Obviously, there's something to it. We need to assess what there is to it and whether it was misappropriation, whether it was positive. But we need to break it down. We can't just flat out say, UFOs,
Yeah, I know. See, they're the irresponsible skeptics who, again, they resort to ad hominem and then they say silly things because they've made up their mind and they're all in on that just as badly as the believers are. Then you've also got some very good points that are raised. Like, again, I mentioned Robert Schaefer at the Bad UFOs blog makes some really good points about the fiscal aspect of this. And should we not know exactly what was being done with taxpayer money as it went into this? But at the end of the day, I will maintain that if there is science and if there is new knowledge that can be acquired, if we can learn new things about the scientific workings of reality, whether this be natural phenomena, again, based on the descriptions given by the Pentagon officials who've been investigating this, Luis Elizondo and others, this sounds to me a lot more like there is a technological origin for the phenomena being observed. The videos seem to be indicative of that as well. It's just a very atypical technology. It is not a technology like something. It's not comparable to anything that we know to exist.
And those videos that we posted, we have to say, you, one of the things, you, first things you told me about them, there's no clear means of propulsion. I mean, these, good, that's point, one, yeah, of the things that makes these videos interesting, that a lot of people, just the basic onlooker, the atypical bystander, is not going to notice. So if you want to go into that, you know more about it than
I do. Well, I'll just say this. At this point in time, what this has all done is this has set something of a precedent. We have set something of a precedent here. There are more questions, however, that emanate from this than there are answers. We do not now have an answer. We don't have a definitive idea or a clear illustration of what the UFO phenomena is. What we have are certainly more questions, but we have a reaction en masse from the media, which is strongly suggestive of a serious treatment of what many have held for a long time to have been, and in truth, at least for decades, a phenomena worthy of scientific discovery. And again, you know, Harry Reid on his own Twitter account, he had tweeted, he says, if anyone says they have the answers, they're fooling themselves. We don't know the answers, but we have plenty of evidence to support asking the questions. This is about science and national security. If America doesn't take the lead in answering these questions, others will. Are we going to take the lead?
I certainly hope so.
That's yet to be seen. And that will have to be the final word on this week's edition of the Graylian Report. Hey, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, season's greetings to all you guys out there. We will be back for at least one more round before we wrap up and head into the new year together. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International, including Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson, Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrail, Tiffany Mack, and the lovely assistant Lauren, Matthew and I will return again here on the Graylian Report, and we bid you adieu as always. You guys stay strange out there and keep your eyes on the skies.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.